Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Star Wars Report podcast. Welcome. Come one, come all. I'm so glad you decided to tune in to this particular hunky-dory, funny, quirky podcast episode. I'm one of your hosts for this evening, Riley Blanton. So glad you joined us. And also joining me, as always, is my dear sister, Bethany Blanton.
Hi, everyone.
You're checking.
I'm excited to be here tonight.
You're checking the mute button. I saw you there, Bethany.
Yeah, I was making sure it was turned on this time.
I'm always the one who makes that mistake, too, as I always mute the mic and forget to unmute it. But welcome back to the Star Wars Report. 43 of these episodes and powering on. So let's welcome the rest of our panel and start with Mr. Mark Herleman.
Hey, greetings, everyone. Glad to be here, as always. Sitting here, got everything primed and ready to go back in the old studio. Let's do it.
All right. Wow. It sounds like we were suddenly underwater. It's Skype. Skype is, you might call Skype the scourge of us podcasters. More on that in a minute. But also, finally, rounding us out is Mr. our novel reviewer, writer extraordinaire, and all-around really cool guy, Aaron Goins. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. Always great to talk to you guys.
All right. And I alluded to it. We have joining us live, what might be a first, a live from the studio podcast interview with Star Wars author extraordinaire. You might know him as the author of he's written a few little franchises, Dragonlance, StarCraft, Warcraft, Guild Wars, just to name a few. His book, Star Wars Scourge, just recently came out. It's on bookshelves everywhere. Please welcome to the Star Wars Report, author Jeff Grubb.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to talk to you, Jeff, and I'm so glad that, well, everything's working. That's always a good start to the interview. But I'm also really excited to talk to a Star Wars author. And now, I understand you're fairly new to the scene, so I'm going to be all selfish and hog the first question, then I'll turn you over to much more experienced and voracious readers that are on the panel to ask you the rest of the questions. But I'm curious, what was the process like getting a gig in the Star Wars universe and writing in the Star Wars universe?
Well, it's two questions, and the first one is I've been working in the Star Wars universe off and on for some time now.
Okay.
Primarily from the gaming end, gaming spectrum of the universe. I was one of the designers on some of the D20. Star Wars RPG product, as well as one of the designers on the Star Wars miniatures game, also from Wizards of the Coast. So I come in from that door in the first place, and we'll probably get to that more later on. As how I got working on a Star Wars novel, I was recommended for the position by another novelist who I've worked with for many years. And he said, yeah, he's worth trying out for a project. And they contacted me, and we went back and settled on this particular plot and this particular set of characters and went forward.
Cool. Well, in that case, I'll leave the floor to you, Aaron.
All right. Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about some of your history in the role-playing games. A lot of people might not know that this book is actually a novelization of the role-playing supplement Tempest Feud back in 2002.
Yes, it was. Yes,
so
10 years old.
Can you tell us? Yeah, 10 years. So can you tell us a little bit about the differences or what you may have had to change from the story to make it fit into a novel format?
Well, it's apples, two different types of media. The original Tempest Feud was written to support the Star Wars D20 game, and what we were looking for was to create a super adventure. It was longer than an average adventure, 128 pages long, and it had an epic nature to it in the fact that much like a movie, it would basically, we'd be on one planet, we'd go to another planet, we'd go to a third planet, it'd have big sweeping arcs and a larger background than you might find in a typical adventure. Now, role-playing game adventures are sold primarily to the GM, so he runs it for his group. So not as many people find out about them, as, say, even in a role-playing game product that was a supplement on the core worlds. That would reach out to a lot of players. So they don't do as many adventures as we do general supplements. So we really wanted to make this a big one. It was, I did the story. Owen K. Stevens did a lot of the mechanics, which is to say the stats, stat blocks, what all the ships were, what all the creatures are, etc. A guy named Rich Redman sort of batted cleanup. So it was the three of us working on that project over time. And it came out and did real well and got a nice response. And it's in that, as a result of that plot, a lot of what is known about Hutts entered into the canon. What I discovered when I was doing research on this book and checking against all the sources, that a lot of the sources tracked back to me, because they ended up quoting material that I had originally put down in the adventure.
I'm curious, what is the difference in the game? Just a general perspective, what is the difference from the gaming world and the novel writing world, would you say?
Well, that was the other half asked the question there. It's different media, different approach. When you're working in an RPG area, you are trying to be as broad as possible. This particular adventure was written to be run in any era. It was to be run where the players are bringing their characters, their player characters, their protagonists into it. So you have to be available to handle all sorts of stuff that, as a novel writer, you wouldn't have to worry about. Do the protagonists have a starship? How do the protagonists feel about Hutts? Do the protagonists have other things going on? Will the adventure be run straight through, or will it be run through one act and then stuff happens, and then you run through another act and stuff happens? You have a lot more control over those issues when you are writing a novel. So when you're writing a game product, you're trying to handle as a wide number of variables as possible. So you can basically streamline and tailor those when you're looking at a particular set of protagonists, Mander Zuma and his merry band, encountering the threat of the Spice Lord. Now, what I discovered as going over to the novel, it was more than just, okay, I'm going to write up an adventure. It was the question of where the characters are coming from, what are their weaknesses, what are they trying to do, how do they resolve their own personal plots. And Mander Zuma, the protagonist, initially started as a very, the character is a shy Jedi. He basically is unsure of himself. He's capable, he's competent. When we put him under pressure, we see he can deliver, but it doesn't feel right for him. He's afraid. It's called imposter syndrome. And I know a lot of creatives who are victim of this, where no matter how well they do, they're sure that someday everybody's going to wake up, realize they're a fraud,
yeah,
and come after them with pitchforks and torches.
Well, we've always
know people like this as well.
Yeah, I think we've all experienced that at some point where you felt like that yourself, which makes it a little bit easier to sympathize sometimes, perhaps.
Exactly. He's a very sympathetic character, and as a result, the story becomes and mirrors off his own personal growth, and I think that's what really works and sets it apart as being just a novelization of a adventure. And as a result of the pieces exist in the RPG that disappeared when it became a novel. In the RPG, you're going across the plateaus of Endergaard, and you have an encounter. And it's a good encounter, but it exists in far as story. It didn't move the characters or the plot forward at all, so it went away. That sort of thing. By the same token, in a novel, I don't have to keep the camera on the protagonist at all times, which is what happens within a role-playing game, because you're sitting around the table and they want to know what's happening to their characters as opposed to what's going off over here with the Spice Lord or the Spice Lord's minions or the matriarch of the Bomu clan. And it gives us a chance to basically move the camera away and foreshadow and give people a feeling of what the plot, what's going on behind the scenes as the characters are dealing with a larger threat.
Now, you said that he's afraid of being found out as a fraud. What's it like to write a character like that? A character that's not maybe, oh, the greatest hero, god of the underworld, or the chosen one, or anything like that. What's it like writing a bit more of a fragile character like that?
A flawed character. I like flawed heroes, in part because it gives you a lot of room to grow. It makes them very empathetic. You could basically sympathize with his situation. It drives a great deal of the plot. I mean, I have said, okay, he's a shy Jedi. He's not sure of himself. What would a Jedi like this do within the larger universe of Star Wars? What do we do within the Jedi Order? And he pulled back. And he's an archivist. He basically, you know, he's studious. He knows more, but he also is using that as a shield to keep the rest of the world out. And part of the plot is what happens that is so dire that requires that not only he has to step out of his comfortable library, but why he is the only one who can deal with this. Nobody else is basically is as equipped to deal with this as he is, and why he wants to do it.
Now, you had mentioned that this role-playing story was written for any era. What made you guys decide to set it when you did, right before the New Jedi Order series kicked off?
The real thing that powered it was I actually created a range of years and said it could happen, you know, between here and here. The big thing was the arrival of the Yuuzhan Vong. And because I still wanted Nal Hutta and Nar Shaddaa to still be around.
Yeah, that would definitely change the landscape. Now, would you call it easy or hard to convert the story to the novel form? I mean, you did basically have the script kind of laid out for you in that regards. But, I mean, from the reviews I've read, like I said, I literally just got it today, so I haven't had a chance to crack it open. But I've heard that there were very few references to really lock it in the era. Was that just one of those things that came apart as you did it and part of the easy-slash-hard style for you?
It was. I basically thought of it as an open era, and as we drilled down and set it in a particular year after the Battle of Yavin, I looked at it and said, where can I make references? And, you know, it's tough to do so without hanging, you know, a big lampshade on it and say, look, this is a reference to this particular part of the era. And one interview asked, you know, if I thought about, you know, cameos from, you know, from the main characters, from the iconic characters. And, you know, at the time I just had the image of, you know, Han shows up and waves at everybody and then leaves. So instead what I was looking at was the long shadows that these characters cast. You know, Luke's not here, but Luke's teachings are here.
Now, did you ever consider including, instead of somebody like Mander or Zuma, who is not established in the expanded universe yet, did you ever consider using a Jedi that had already been established in other novels?
I did consider initially, and when we proposed this book, this was one of like 8 different novels. I gave them 8 different ideas that were all over the joint. Some had iconic characters in them, some had minor characters, some had new characters. One was the autobiography of Jar Jar Binks, different eras. And what I felt with is to get a character that fit the story. And in this case, Mander Zuma fit the story because I was very comfortable with, as opposed to trying to force another character into the events that occur here. So he's very closely tied with the plot. Basically, his drive is much stronger than, say, another Jedi that could be chosen.
It's interesting, though, It's interesting, though, that your story doesn't have a lot of these main characters at a time when a lot of people are kind of wanting to see the big three as it is, you know, kind of set off to the side and new, fresh EU characters coming out. I just found that was, like, just too good to be true. I mean, you know, people have been clamoring for that for a long time, and then, bam, here comes your book, and it delivers just that.
And I'll be honest, it's an experiment and a risk. because, yes, you know, people complain about, you know, every book about Han and Luke and Leia, and yet, or even a majority of the books and their descendants, but by the same token, that's very comfortable. That's a story. What this is doing is talking about the universe as being the star. It's basically talking about a lot of pieces that are seen through the main character's eyes in other other books and in the movies.
And you had kind of, it seems like you kind of flipped the script a little bit on the way that we look at some of these elements in the Star Wars universe. For example, you have the Jedi who's not overconfident. You had some Wookiees in there that were basically criminals. Usually we look at Wookiees as being more of a noble species.
Bad guys.
And then you had, yeah, and then you had even your Hutts that you have are a little bit different than what we typically see from the Hutts. So I was wondering if you were kind of making a conscious effort to kind of make us reevaluate the way we look at some of these elements in Star Wars.
Yes, in particular the aliens. And I think it's a part, I guess, a part of my heritage. I come out of writing role-playing material in which we talk about other alien races, alien species. We talk about other planets. We talk about, you know, a wide variety of ships and everything and all the wonderful toys. And this comes out of the original West End version and comes out of the D20 version from Wizards. And this is just, these are tools that I'm very familiar with and very comfortable with. So talking about the races, only in later that I've been discovering that, yeah, the species tend to be marginalized. And I wanted to get them out of the cantina, out of Jabba's palace, get them a broader space. The foundation is there in the movies, the non-human species with movies, but expanding it out further and showing you it's their universe as well.
Another thing I've noticed is that you have the reference to the Jedi Temple and the training center as the Jedi Praxium, like we see in I, Jedi in the earlier Bantam era books. Was that something that you did to kind of bring people back to that era? Because it kind of like, it's cusping like the end of that era and right before the new Jedi Order kicks off. Was that intentional, or is that just something like you've always thought of it as the Jedi Praxium and just rolled that direction?
I thought of it as the Praxium, and I wanted to give it that sense of grounding. And I'm not sure if I got that right or not, to be honest with you. I think I did.
And I was wondering, I noticed that you had included a couple characters that were Pantoran, and they've been featured recently in the Clone Wars television series. So I was wondering if the television series had any influence on you using that race, and if you're a fan of the Clone Wars series.
I am a fan of the Clone Wars series. The series did have an effect on me using Pantorans because originally in the first draft they were Runians, which was another blue-skinned race. And at one point in working with Lucasfilms, they asked for very few changes as far as to the initial plot presentation, but one of them was we have... We've talked about Pantorans. We've shown them in the Clone Wars television show. Can you use a Pantoran instead? And I said sure. And that evolved into Renan Toro, my Pantorans. But they were very much a case where they were a different species initially. The television show I enjoy. Both because it, you know, again, a different media, a different approach. It basically is a lot more action oriented. It's a lot more. It's very fluid because, you're not dealing with real people as opposed to cartoon avatars. And I really like a lot of what I've seen. I pulled my hot funeral rituals out of an episode with Zero and Big Mama.
I did notice that.
Yes. It helps ground the universe. It's a minor piece, but it is. Well, oh, okay. We know how
if
to
there's,
do this.
I will say this, Jeff. If there's one thing that can ground things, it is Mama the Hutt.
Well, it's very okay. It's Truman Capote, and Tennessee Williams, you know.
Yeah.
It's very much, you know, I've always depended upon the kindness of strangers as far as the riff that Big Mama gives us. So.
So a question we have from Twitter for you is, which would smell worse?
Oh, boy.
The inside of a hut or the inside of a tauntaun?
Oh, my. I would go with the inside of a hut, only because, you know, you do get some warning with it as far as how bad it's going to be. But yeah, one piece of feedback in the early draft with a rather messy explosion in the book involving huts is to, you know, dial it back half a notch.
Ew.
So,
sorry.
The original was much grosser.
Oh, I've got to jump in. I'm curious, because what is that process like? Do you how much creative freedom do you have when writing a Star Wars book? Is there a cutoff? Is there a, you know, you can't go this far? And are there definitive lines, or is it just you kind of strike in the dark and see what happens?
Yes, they are. But you know, my dwarven characters in D&D say, if you don't know it's a wall until you push. And I have worked in a lot of different licenses with a lot of different sets of rules, and they evolve over time. Because sometimes you'll get, you know, no, we will never do this, never, 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 and then 2 years later you'll see someone do it. Just because, yeah, you see it's both a change, it's a living world. It basically evolves, it changes, people's attitude changes toward it as a license, and we see growth, and that's kind of cool. They were very, I think a lot of the stuff that they really didn't want to see may have been in some of the other proposals, so they sort of say, well, what about this one over here? So, okay.
Gotcha.
And I gave them a very tight outline. As far as, you know, and having the benefit of the original Tempest Feud, which forms like the spine of the book, a lot of what I've said has already entered into canon.
Now, you used a lot of Huttese in the book. Did you make any of that up yourself, or was that something that came from previous sources?
I got a lot of it from online sources and or the phrase book that Sergio Aragonés drew the illos for all those years ago. They had a whole, you know, a phrase book to the galaxy, and I had things how to say, please don't kill me in Huttese. So that was there. I also, where I had no clue, I suggested. And one of the documents I turned over when I turned over first draft was, here's all the Huttese I created. You know, what do you think? And again, the response was, this works. Here's a similar line. You know, is it going to sound like this line? And working from there, so basically creating the illusion of the unified language because from all the examples that have been presented to date. So you can look at it and say, okay, I believe this is Huttese. Someone will come up
now
with the grammar
did.
Eventually. It is all over the place.
Yeah. Now, you did kind of have the makings of a bit of a love triangle in the book with Mander and Reen and Angela. I was wondering if you ever considered including any romantic elements in the book.
No, because the big... I have a funny feeling that Mander, for this part of it, would be clueless. Not because he's an innocent, per se, but because he's so driven in a different direction. His question of what happened to his student and who is responsible, I think, is a much stronger drive. And part of who he is works well with the female characters. And they have their own drives as well. So they're sort of together as opposed to setting up a Betty and Veronica sort of thing with... Angela and Reen are very, very different characters, and you know, I see them, you know, as their personalities and their upbringing just sparking off each other. I mean, Angela would see Reen as just chaos, and Reen sees Angela as, you know, by the book, tightly wound, And, you know, that basically provides a lot more interesting stuff as far as how their characters interact.
Okay. And do you, now you introduced some really cool characters into the Star Wars galaxy, the three that you were just talking about, as well as, is it Eddie Beret? Is that how you say it?
Eddie Beret. And, yeah. Oh my God, he was an interesting, you know, I talked about writing a tile outline, but sometimes you'll write something and you will discover that the character is going in a completely different direction. Eddie Beret was originally not supposed to have any lines. He was going to be like Teller from Penn and Teller. He was going to be the quiet one. And then a situation came up and he got a great killer line. You know, in a situation comedy, there's always a character that gets a killer line. And, well, he got it. And then it came up again. And it came up again. I realized I was going to have to rewrite and rethink his personality because he actually does, he is very erudite. And he is got that, you know, that little zinger in his available, and why are both and Bothans so good at gathering information? And Eddie's way of doing it is literally to just blend in. He's there, and you know he'll be part of the conversation, and then he'll be gone. He'll just fade out, you know, and people will forget that he's there. And I think this actually is a thing in the universe itself. I think people tend to forget that. A definitely non-human alien species, a member of the alien species, is present at the table sometimes when they talk. And I think that's one thing Bothans use as an information gathering. It's a very social mechanism. So he picks up tons of stuff from a lot. He's an information aggregator. So he's a font of useless information.
Yeah. He was definitely one of my favorite characters in the book, and I'm hoping to learn more about these characters. Are you planning on pitching any further stories for the main cast of this book?
I have, you know, made some inquiries, but there's nothing currently in the works.
Okay. Well, I was wondering, what is it about Star Wars that draws you to it? What makes you enjoy Star Wars?
I like the epic nature of it. I like the excitement. It is space fantasy. It is, the Hutts are very much, you know, dragons. We have lightsabers for swords. We have a mystic order of Jedi Knights. And it does reach back into a lot of archetype material. It's got things, it's got different, and it's a big universe. I've described that there are three types of novels that I've enjoyed, and you know, one is the war novel, about the clone troopers, the stormtroopers, rebel squadron. There are the Jedi stories, which tend to be about the big three and the Jedi Order and the evolution and rebuilding. And there are what I call scum and villainy books. And Han Solo at Star's End was like the first of them. I really liked that book. From, you know, this is, I'm dating myself, I'm ancient, but. Which first introduced the corporate sector. But that type of book I find I'm particularly drawn to because, you know, it basically is the fringes of the wider galaxy. And Scourge started as a scum and villainy book and became a Jedi book. It became a lot about Jedi philosophy and Jedi thinking and the responsibility that comes with having this level of power.
Mm-hmm. Now, before in the chat, the pre-chat, when we started the call, you had mentioned about how it came back and you were kind of the authority on a lot of the Hutt stuff from the RPG books that you had wrote. Did you find writing Hutts back then versus now a little different? I mean, because, you know, in the Clone Wars, we watched Zero die, and a lot of people were like, whoa, a bastard did that. I mean, were there any major changes from the then and now regarding the Hutts?
I think the death of Zero basically showed a lot more fragility to the Hutts. You know, on one hand, they live, you know, thousands of years, but on the other hand, they have a lot of personal body armor in the way of minions and servants and people who are willing to leap in front of a blaster for them. So you have to be very crafty to get to that level, and I think that survives as their armor. In doing the research, I realized that the leading cause of Hutts is Princess Leia. Just, you know, more Hutts die to her than, you know, any other cause. that's part of it. I think that makes them a lot more accessible a lot more usable. An invulnerable bad guy is always tough because you're always trying to have to find out how to get around the invulnerability.
Now,
awesome.
I have a question for you from someone from Lane in the chat, and he wants to know if you had any chance to write anything at all in the Star Wars universe, what would you write?
Ooh,
this book was up on the, it was up high up on the list to start with.
Oh, that's nice.
And I was joking earlier about, you know, the autobiography of Jar Jar Binks, and I think that would be a wonderful challenge. I find the era leading up to A New Hope to be extremely interesting and fertile because we know how it's going to end. It's going to end in tears, but the victories that you take as you go along and you as you try to stem the tide of the Emperor is, I think, an important component and has, you know, a lot of good story bit to it.
Now, Jeff, we're coming to the close, and I'll thank you right now for all the time you've given us this evening. We really appreciate it. But I don't want to close with telling a brief little story. Now, back in the day, the 14-year-old me, or however old it was at the time, Revenge of the Sith was coming out, and there were these really, really awesome new toys coming out. They were called Attack-tics.
Oh, God, yes. I didn't even mention that. Yes, from Hasbro.
I understand. Mm-hmm. You were involved in those somehow.
I was involved in those, yes. The mechanic was developed by a friend of mine, Steve Connard, originally pitched as a fantasy game. Now, for those who haven't seen it, they were an action figure about 2 inches tall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It might have like a pivot on its waist and a spring loaded or a weapon, and you had it was on a base, and the base would click as you moved it forward, and that's how you measured distance and how many clicks, attack ticks, how many ticks you had.
Let me tell you something, Jeff.
And then you would base.
It was.
Pardon?
Oh, I was just going to say. Let me tell you those things as you described them. I've mentioned it once on the show, but I will still tell you this. I must have, over the 2 or 3 years those things ran, I must have 200 of those things, like in totes.
Oh, wow!
And it's like everybody has their childhood story of like, man, it was 1976. And I was pre-ordering the Hasbro. Mine is, I sunk a lot of my money into those, and I thought those were going to be out for years. I was set. These were the cool new toys.
Yeah.
And of course, unfortunately, they didn't last as long as young me had hoped. But I still carry them to this day.
It did have, did you have a hut?
Yes, I did. I actually, it was really hard to get, but I traded a friend for the job of the
hut.
It was
like one of the last figures. It was an oversized figure that shot marbles.
Yes, I have it. And I don't have it with me, but I do have a few tactics right here at the desk, I believe. I have to look up at the recording studio.
You have no idea how many hours we spent playing this.
Oh, hours. It was awesome, but I will say that. So you had an impact on this young lad's life. But I want to close out with one question. And that is, what is, and I don't want to end on too much of a downer, but what is your greatest regret when it comes specifically to Star Wars, and what did you learn from that as you grew as an author?
Hmm. Wow.
Not to toss you a hardball one right at the end.
For this project or overall? For this project,
I would just say overall, what is something you can cap us off with wise words of wisdom from Jeff Grubb of something that you've learned personally working in the Star Wars world?
Ah, okay. I'll pass on. This was approach. It's been voiced by a guy named Bill Slavicek. Worked on the Wizards, the West End game, and was my manager at Wizards of the Coast and the designer of the Star Wars one of the designers of the Star Wars D20 game. And he referred to Uncle George's minivan.
Uncle George's minivan?
Uncle George's minivan. We can play with the toys. we can, you know, enjoy the creativity that many creative people have put together in the Star Eats Wars universe. But if we leave our tricycle in the driveway and Uncle George backs the minivan over it, it's not really his fault. In other words, it's a dynamic world, a living world, a changing world. I know when the new movies came out and then the Clone Wars came out, there's a lot of, oh my God, it's, you know, uprooting canon. And it's changing, you know, how we view it. But that's one of the prices you pay when you have a living universe, when it be it Forgotten Realms or the Marvel Superheroes universe or Star Wars, is that things will change, sometimes retroactively. Sometimes we'll get an insight or a piece of information we never had before. And I think that's part of the best survival advice for any buddy creating in a shared universe, is that things change over time.
They do indeed. Wow. Well, Jeff, thank you so much. We really appreciate you giving us some of your time this evening. Hey, do you think you'll be at any events anytime soon? Perhaps a little gathering in Orlando this summer?
No plans. A lot of my travel is tied up in my day job, which is working building worlds for a computer game company. I'm working on Guild Wars 2 for ArenaNet, so we'll probably be at things like PAX and showing off the game.
Cool. Well, where's the best place for people to find more information on you and your projects?
For Star Wars itself, the Star Wars books blog, Suvudu, is that correct? Basically had like the first 50 pages of the book up and available to give people a sample. My own personal blog is grubstreet.blogspot.com. But be warned, even though I'm talking about Star Wars a lot on it right now, I'll soon go back to talking about local politics and collectible quarters. You know, I use it as a place where I can just, you know, to talk about whatever comes into my head. So,
all right.
Which is dangerous.
Well, Jeff, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. And we'll be talking, and thank you so much for talking to us tonight.
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, man. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And may the Force be with you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Grubb. Round of applause. Woohoo! All right. Wow, joining us live, on the run from the Imperials. I always love talking. I mean, it's fun with the microphones, but cell phones really just make it sound that much more underground in a cool way. And I really appreciate Jeff taking the time tonight. And Aaron, thank you so much for getting the advanced review copy, reading voraciously, ripping through that thing. You've got your review up on StarWarsReport.com, I believe.
Yep, I do.
All right, excellent. And we thank you again for coming on and all of your excellent thought-provoking questions.
Well, thanks for having me on, guys. I will catch up with you later.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, man. And for those of you still tuned into us, stay tuned. We've got homeowners associations to talk about. We've got George Lucas the sellout, and also right now, exclusive to our live audience. If you are within the sound of my voice right now, 8:37 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Thursday, April the 26th. That's you.
And you can tell him how many fingers he's holding up right now.
Right now. How many fingers do I have behind my back? We're doing some giveaways. So, Bethany, let's start with the Twitter one, and we'll give a few minutes for people who are in the chat. And so this is your turf. What are we doing here?
Okay. Our Twitter giveaway winner today is... I have all of your names input into random.org, so I'm going to
basically the virtual basket that we're reaching into.
Yes. Now I'm going to click the randomize button. Click. Our Twitter winner is at Aaron Petzer.
Aaron
Petzer. Sir, you are a winner.
Welcome. Thank you so much. Thank you for participating in the giveaway. We really appreciate it. What you got to do, my boy?
Win here, win there.
Win everywhere is what you got to do. What you stay? I'm going to be useless. I'm going to be getting songs stuck in my head. Is send us a what? DM, direct message?
Let's have him send us an email.
Email, do both. Send us, I think if we're following you, or I'm not sure, Twitter's weird about who's following who on DMs, but if you can't DM us your address, Aaron, I believe? Aaron
yes.
Aaron Petzer? Petz?
Pitzer.
Yes. All right.
Who knows if that's his
real name. Shoot us your email, and we'll let you know via Twitter as well. And boom, you'll get your own shiny copy of Star Wars Scourge, pronounced
You're never going to let us forget that, are you?
Yeah. All right. I'm still calling him Coran Horn. I don't care.
And so how do we want to do the live giveaway to those of the audience tuned in live on Middle Earth Network Radio?
All righty. I am going back to the randomized drum roll. Click. The winner of our live giveaway. Like, can you stop now?
Okay, all right.
Thank you. Is Admiral Rex. Congratulations, sir.
Howdy there. Whoa. I'm Admiral Rex. You may have heard my brother Tex.
Okay, now.
Oh, I'm Admiral Rex.
Rex, you're going to have to email us.
Same email, StarWarsReport@gmail.com. And congratulations, sir. That's it. And we'll do more of these giveaways. And as they're available, and the good folks at Delray let us do it, we'll be doing these live. I know we're in a smaller audience, so tell you what, listen live, and you've got a better shot. Speaking of...
Odds are in your favor.
I'm going to do this right now because I'll regret it if I don't. Before we jump into news, let's jump into May. When did Attack of the Clones come out? I know now is a perfect time to look it up live on radio. Attack of the Clones 3D release date is the first prompter for Google. May 16th. So on or about, we're going to tentatively plan. Announcement time while we're doing announcements. Approximately there about May 16th, which this year is going to be May 17th. That Thursday night, if all goes well, that will be, excuse me, that will be the day that we'll be doing live Attack of the Clones commentary. I know I haven't really talked to you, Bethany, or Mark about it, so we're talking about it now on air. But yeah, let's do it then. Let's block off our Thursday night. We'll probably end up starting a little bit early. We'll keep you informed as details come forward as we book some guests, hopefully take some live calls. I'm the owner of a shiny new computer. It's so exciting.
Yeah.
It's so exciting.
At least somebody's got a new one.
Yeah. Well, it saved up a bit of money over time, and it was me realizing that there's no way on earth that I'm going to be able to afford to go to New Zealand this fall as much as I was going to try. Or at least there is a way. I shouldn't say that. Where there's a will, there's a way. Do or do not, there is no try. But I realized that that wouldn't be a priority for me this particular year. Single tier, but that means I rebudgeted, and so I have a computer that actually has the ability to do a bunch of video casts. So we'll try to see if we can do that as a big live video cast with guests and all that fun stuff. Again, May 17th, Thursday, tentatively planned. We'll update you next week as we get ready to go. All right, so let's do it. Before we jump into our news, they're back. You know, and you guys know who I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
ToyHut.com. They are back sponsoring more episodes of the StarWarsReport.com. Toy Hut, your place. The place to get Star Wars action figures and memorabilia. We thank them so much for their continued support of StarWarsReport.com. I'll say it right now. Go to the website show notes for episode 43 of the Star Wars Report. There you can click on a link there, peruse around, and find what action figures you particularly want. They're hitting the convention season. They're doing giveaways like every hour at conventions. Lexington Comic Con's coming. Fanboy Expo in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. I kid you not. Not but a few hours from where we live. I'll be busy at that time. I'll be jumping around on C-130s at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Arizona. Bethany, you have yet to decide, I think. You might not. We'll see.
Possibly.
I'm trying to convince her.
Summer as well, too.
Maybe she'll do it.
It would be nice to go.
Maybe. All right. Maybe.
$100.
Give me $100 and grovel.
All kinds of cool people at Fanboy Expo at Pigeon Forge, including the lovely and talented Anna Graves, voice of Satine on the Clone Wars, recent interviewee on the Star Wars Report. which is really cool. So yeah, Lexington Comic Con, they do giveaways every 30 minutes as well sometimes. So that's going to be really cool. Some cool celebration plans hopefully coming together that we'll be working with Toy Hut to do.
They'll be attending the fanboyexpo.com, and they'll be doing their 30-minute giveaways as well.
Yeah.
Basically what they do is they have all sorts of wonderful Star Wars stuff, including toys and action figures and cool swag that they give away every 30 minutes. So you can go by their booth as you're going through the con and, hey, free cool Star Wars stuff. What's not to like?
Yeah, exactly. So where you want to go, you want to go to toyhut.com, Toy Hut with two T's, and hey, head over to their Facebook page where you can find Toy Hut. They're almost to 10K fans on Facebook.
10,000.
So let's push them over. Let's push them over. Push them over to 10K fans on Facebook, and there you can
let's
get
do it.
That. Hey, spend $75, get a 20% off discount as well. Mm-hmm. Again, toyhut.com. Go to them through the StarWarsReport.com episode show notes as a way of supporting this show and thanking them for supporting our show, our little shenanigans here. All right, I think that's going to do it. Let's jump into the news.
We have something to report.
Come closer, I have good news.
Data brought to us by the Bothan spies.
We can send a clear transmission.
There it is. Listen.
Beep, beep.
It worked. Yes, it worked. Sing it, R2. All right, so we got some stuff. Only got a couple minutes to cover a story. So what I'm going to do is jump straight through an email response, and I'm going to do email first, and then what we'll do is see if we have a little bit of extra time for some of the other articles we did. So I'm going to jump to email first. This is from an email from Eric. He says, thanks, Riley, for recording a solo show last week. All right, I'll get through the whole email, but I'm just going to stop and say, you're welcome, Eric. I appreciate you thanking me. That felt really good. I appreciate that. Good times. That was fun. All right. Jumping right along. It wasn't much. I really was just reading the article about George Lucas selling out last week, pretty much verbatim, and offering some feedback. So anyway, says,
don't self-deprecate.
All right. It was hard work, and by golly, I deserve it all. Was that better, or was that too much on the opposite end?
I think that was a little too much on the opposite end.
Like, there's a line in the middle.
Yeah.
And I fled to the other end.
Uh-huh.
All right.
He said,
I never thought much about the accusations that George Lucas is a sellout because no one seemed to have an explanation to back it up. You picked a good article as a primer for the topic. Where did George Lucas sell out? People could argue it's the merchandising, but regardless of how much money Lucasfilm rakes in from merchandise sales, I doubt the toys or money from their sales compromise George Lucas' creative vision in any way. I'll add commentary at the end. I agree with you. let's see. All that leaves is the motion pictures, the special editions, the prequels, and the current TV show. But Lucas stuck to his vision and even changed it a bit with the special editions. Despite fan backlash, he followed through with his own story, creating all three prequels, regardless of fans who publicly slandered the new films from the very beginning. He even wrote and directed the new films himself to make sure that they were accurate to his vision. Now that he's commissioned a television series and personally inputs into the creative process to steer it towards his vision of the Clone Wars, no matter what anyone else thinks or what was written before. The fact is that Lucas owns Star Wars, while most movies that are made today seem to be owned by the production companies that put them on the big screen. He's in a position to decide everything that happens to his creation, and he never has to look at the quote-unquote bottom line, as they say, trying to sell his vision according to what the market will like. Unfortunately, in the day and age where fan outcry can cause developers to change the ending of a story like Mass Effect 3...
Yeah, that was pretty interesting.
Brave people like George Lucas are a dying breed, Eric. So he's responding to the article where he said George Lucas is kind of... People don't hate him because he's a sellout. They hate him because he refuses to, because he won't listen to fans and do what's popular. Like, he'll do literally... almost no one will say that Greedo shooting first is a good decision, but he has stuck to his guns over the years. Same deal with the release of the original theatrical versions that he hasn't released, even though he could sell a big, fat bunch of them. So it was basically... Fans don't my favorite sentence. Fans don't hate George Lucas because he's sold out. They hate him because he refuses to. And
I think that people are looking at that sellout in multiple ways. I mean, there are some contingents of fans that do feel he sold them out. You know, that they have been loyal to what little Star Wars was out there for so long.
Yeah.
And everything at that time was according to his original vision. And then he went to do the prequel trilogy and decided that he was going to shift it up. Yes, it is his right. Sure, but, you know, these people have already paid their money to get what was the vision at that time and turn around and, wait a minute, that's not quite the same thing. And I go to my mom on this because my mom will not watch the prequel movies because to her, that's not what Star Wars was. That was not,
it's not
the
Star
movies
Wars
that
to
she
her,
watched.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there is that feeling that you see a lot of. And I to me, that's the legitimate one. If anyone's going to be complaining about a sellout, it's the fact that he does stick to his guns. But his vision, this vision, is not a vision that he's had since 1977. It, like everything in life, is ever evolving. Sure. And yet people quote it like it's, oh, well, he's had this since 1977, written down like the Bible. It never changes at all.
Ha.
BS!
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and here's the thing about that. Like Jeff Grubb said earlier, he said one thing that he really likes about Star Wars is the epicness of it. It transcends its own story in many ways.
It does, yeah.
And that Star Wars keeps growing.
Well, and I love the quote about the minivan. It's like, yeah. It's so true because it is changing. And George may run over your tricycle. You can play in his driveway, but he may run over your tricycle. Does that mean you didn't enjoy the tricycle while, you know, the tricycle was there? No, but you can't enjoy the tricycle now as much. So you got your enjoyment out of the tricycle before it was flatlined by the Lucas minivan.
This is heading in the right direction.
It's when it's like the tricycle is produced and it's told to the people, well, this is a great George Lucas approved bicycle.
Look at this tricycle.
Wait, no, George just ran it over because somebody left it out. It's like, how did they leave it out? Oh, because George forgot to tell him something. And so they just assumed, yes, it falls on them because they made that assumption based off of the information that was given to them. But you never see a writer get the little sit-down that the writers for the Clone Wars TV show do. They get these one-on-ones with George. How many writers have had that opportunity? I don't think we have hardly any, maybe four.
Yeah.
And that's the frustrating part as a fan of the EU. You want it all to line up. But when George is sitting back and not giving all these details and he's waiting because he wants to get the ratings up or whatever, it becomes like, well, why would you do that? And then you see these books that kind of fall away. That's where you see a lot of that. Well, he sold out. Well, this story here that Timothy Zahn wrote, well, half this information is now outdated because of something that came up down the road. And that's where you get that feeling of like, well, what I paid for just got sold out. And, you know, I get where they're coming from, where he stuck to his guns, but there is a measurement there of some truth to a certain element of fans. There are certain groups that really do feel like it and can see that, yeah, he did to a degree sell them out.
I think what the article, I think its best point was it put it in a new perspective for me where fans, you know, can have a right to be angry if they don't like the prequels or don't like the things that George Lucas have done. You know, that is fine, but I think that they can be intellectually dishonest sometimes where instead of they're saying that he's doing it for marketing reasons or because he's an evil rich guy. I think it's just because he's confident, egotistical type of guy in a healthy way, not necessarily. I mean, maybe he can be a really, very strong personality, but he wants what he wants. I don't think it's a matter of him wanting more money, which is usually the default argument saying, oh, well, he just wants more money. I think it's just he wants what he wants. So like it or not, that seems to be the reality of the situation.
And as Lane says in the chat, he feels it's important to point out that Lucas is within his rights to make changes he sees fit. But the fact that he owns the universe doesn't elevate him above criticism,
no.
As long as it's objective criticism.
And there's some very good criticism of Lucas out there.
Yeah, some unobjective criticism would be, for instance, if I were to say, Lane, you hater, you're not a Star Wars fan, you're just, I'm insulted, which I'm not. So it's more of a, let's think about this critically and learn critically in a critical thinking way and learn from it on either side.
Imagine how different things would have been if the actual producing company got a hold of the rights and they said, no, George, no.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of things could have turned out a heck of a lot worse than what we got. I mean, we always just assume it's going to be rainbows and clouds. I mean, it could be thunderstorms around that horizon.
It could be. Yeah, it could be. Well, next week we'll talk about an update. Forbes.com has a great op-ed about the How Lucasfilm Lost. to a Lucas Valley Homeowners Association.
Yep.
So that's coming up next week. We appreciate everybody tuning into this episode of the Star Wars Report, episode 33. Thank you so much to Jeff Grubb for joining us for such a long and an awesome interview that he gave us. We really appreciate it. Star Wars Scourge on the bookshelves now. Everybody go check it out. Thank you to Aaron for joining us. And thank you to you for tuning in this podcast episode. You can contact us mainly through StarWarsReport.com. That's where you're going to find everything. Don't forget that Attack of the Clones live show, video show that Riley hopes might somehow go well.
Star Wars.
Nothing but Star Wars.
You can sing louder than I can.
I hope I didn't blast anybody's ears there. Yeah, StarWarsReport.com. That's where you'll find our Twitter, at StarWarsReport. Facebook.com/StarWarsReport. Posting funny videos there each and every week. Cursing timeline each and every week. those are some great ways. You can email us with your opinions on this particular story of George Lucas, the sellout. He just wants more money. What's your opinion? Email us, StarWarsReport@gmail.com. We'll continue our...
Well, how else is that live-action show going to go? I mean, sell out, George. Get that money and put that live-action show
that?
On the TV.
I don't seem to remember what you're talking about.
What live show? Live-action show? A live variety show with Max Rebo. Joining us is Greedo's cousin, Greedo, the merciless slaughter of your cousin, Greedo. Was it race-related? Okay, that's all.
I've got big eyes.
Who
now.
Shot first? Was it self-defense? Getting a little too much into modern events there. All right, I'm going to wrap it up before I go any further. You've been listening to Star Wars Report, episode 43, excuse me, we're further than that, live on StarWarsReport.com. So long, folks. And remember, many Bothans died to bring you this podcast. And by many Bothans, there's actually a guy named Manny Bothans.
We're going to have to talk about that sometime.
Manny Bothans. Yeah, it's Manny Bothans. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Mark, you got 10 seconds to play the R2.
Sorry, buddy. I had his restraining bolt on. He was like sitting there rocking at me. What are you doing?